From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll look at how Wisconsin politicians are reacting to the Trump administration's actions and how they could impact people here in the state.
As for what's impacting us in Wisconsin, I mean, we're trying to figure that out every day. Head Start, for example, say they're having problems accessing funding that's been allocated to them and making payroll. So there's definitely some impacts coming. We just don't really know right now.
Then our Books and Beyond series goes from the stacks to the stove at the Cargill Community Kitchen.
This is an opportunity that they probably wouldn't expect at the library because it is non-traditional, but the community meals are my way of being able to break the mold and to show the evolution of libraries.
Plus, we'll explore the Milwaukee Public Library's historic recipe files. All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. We'll start today with Capitol Notes. The whirlwind of orders coming out of the new presidential administration is going to have an impact here in Wisconsin. Here's WUWM's Mayan Silver, breaking that down with J.R. Ross from WisPolitics.
This is Capitol Notes from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mayan Silver. Today we ask J.R. Ross about both Washington and Madison. Ross is editor of WisPolitics.com. Welcome, J.R. Thanks for being here.
No, thanks for having me.
All right, so during his first 2 weeks in office, Republican President Donald Trump has fired federal prosecutors and agency watchdogs across the government. He offered government employees payouts to resign, threatening mass layoffs if they didn't. He tried to freeze trillions of dollars of federal grants and loans. Almost all USAID staff are being placed on leave, and the FBI and Education Department are also on the chopping block. Elon Musk, who hasn't been elected, has nearly unfettered access to the Treasury Department's payment system, which disburses trillions in payments each year, including Social Security checks and federal salaries. Wow, that was a mouthful. What are your takeaways in watching this unfold, JR? And do you know at this point the main ways this could be affecting people in Wisconsin?
Well, on the first question, you know, talking to people, it's been kind of like the Trump trademark of like shock and awe, like flood the zone with so many things going on. There's just so much coming out of D.C. that it makes it hard for Democrats to find their footing to respond. When there was the order that kind of seemed to freeze, at least temporarily, payments for domestic programs, Democrats found their feet for a little bit and had like some solid ground to push back. It's been interesting to watch a reaction to the freeze, for example, on USAID, which, you know, I'm not going to debate the policy was good or bad. But if you look at the election last fall, people, generally speaking, they wanted change. They did not want to keep sending money overseas. They want to focus on the United States. That was the choice they made. And you're seeing it a little bit more difficult for Democrats to kind of find their footing, pushing back on that stuff. Not saying there isn't something valuable there to push back upon, but it's a different dynamic. And what I'm getting at is that if it's stuff that hurts people in this country, Democrats seem to have a better shot at getting the public to buy in and be concerned. When it's something going overseas, it's not nearly as clean a message for them. As for what's impacting us in Wisconsin, I mean, we're trying to figure that out every day. It's been interesting, you know, you see Head Start, for example, say they're having problems accessing funding that's been allocated to them and making payroll. So there's definitely some impacts coming. We see UW-Madison, for example, trying to navigate what's this mean for research projects? How should we go going forward? We just don't really know right now. Oh, by the way, will there be more coming down the pipe? Because there's a budget that's due from Governor Evers in next week, the 18th, he's supposed to release it. Could that be impacted? We don't know. We just don't. That's the bottom. We just don't know for sure what this all means. It could take a while for the dust to settle.
And you mentioned Democratic Attorney General Josh Calls joining in out of a lawsuit to pause the federal funding freeze. What's the latest on that, and how else are people in Wisconsin pushing back?
Well, we've seen a couple of pauses. From the multi-state effort that Call joined. There's another in another federal court. We're seeing various lawsuits filed. There was a protest in Madison last week, just starting to kind of get its legs. What I'm kind of watching in my conversation with people is, if you go back to early years of the Obama administration, right? Obama won this big election, push some big changes to deal with the economy at the time and the Affordable Care Act. And you saw this kind of groundswell begin that at first seemed not very big, but it built over that first year of the Obama administration and became the Tea Party movement. Will we see Democrats get organized, get off the mat after, you know, pretty crushing defeat in November and start to push back in an effective way? You know, talking to people in the Capitol, they will tell you that Democrats were definitely depressed in November after their loss. And their wonder was, what will get them back into kind of like be motivated to get engaged? Well, Donald Trump has unique effect on Democrats, unique motivator when it comes to Democrats. And so they're watching, do these policies serve to kind of get people going in? And two, there's just so much going on. Is it so much chaos that just kind of gets people like overwhelmed with what's coming out of Washington, D.C. and makes it harder to get motivated?
So, you know, one of the other things the Trump administration is trying to do is scrub DEI from the government. He ordered that each federal agency must get rid of that, and in environmental justice offices. Major corporations which signed on to DEI efforts are just as quickly dismantling those programs. Can you remind us of what's happened related to DEI in recent years in Wisconsin, and where do you think the battle over DEI will continue to play out here?
The most obvious thing is with the universities of Wisconsin. It's been a year or so where Robin Voss, the Assembly Speaker, struck a deal with UW leaders to freeze the number of DEI positions in the system, to reassign them, some of them to other jobs. And in return, he agreed to allow pay raises to take effect for UW employees. Well, don't forget, Robin Voss and Republican lawmakers in general asked the Legislative Audit Bureau, which is the nonpartisan kind of audit arm of the legislature, to do a review of DEI across state government. That review is going to be out any day now. We're watching for that. That will be the platform that Republican lawmakers use in the budget to try to root out DEI in state government. It's going to be fascinating to watch how that debate plays out, how Governor Evers reacts to that, and what Democratic lawmakers do, right? Because we have this thing in politics where we kind of fight the last battle when we're trying to do the next one. And I'm getting at is that DEI was a big deal in 2024. Immigration is a big deal in 2024. Will they be a big issue going forward? We'll see. You know, do the actions that Trump has taken, will they take those things off the table and make people not really that concerned about them, right? So I don't know. That's a ways and away. But watch for that DEI audit for the come up with lawmakers and watch how they use that in this budget to target programs that state now pays for.
You're tuned into Capitol Notes. I'm WEWM's Maayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WizPolitics.com. And you mentioned immigration as well in your answer there. Last week, Wisconsin Republicans sort of telegraphed their idea. They have a bill to require people who are arrested on felony charges to prove that they're in the country legally. If the person can't do that, then the whatever county sheriff would be in that particular situation would have to report the person to the Department of Homeland Security. What's the discourse right now about that bill?
Well, there are a couple of things. One, there's the policy. Republicans believe in it. It is definitely a message coming out of Washington, D.C. with the Trump administration of cracking down of those here without documentation. And the public, generally speaking, the polls, agrees with it. What I'm watching is how the politics play out. Again, Governor Evers, you know, he hasn't said he's going to run in 2026. If he does, if this bill gets to his desk, he vetoes it, will it be an issue next fall? Maybe. I'm not going to predict what's going to be the dominant issue a year and 10 months from now, whatever it is, until that election. So we'll see. Also, for Democrats, they picked a lot of seats in the Assembly and the Senate this past fall in the new maps. Robin Voss, the Assembly Speaker, he wants to put some of these new members in the Assembly on record. Where do you stand on these immigration issues? You know, after the rhetoric you had on the campaign trail, where are you at on this issue? And could it be fodder for campaign ads next fall? Because politics never rests in this building. There's always something political going on or something behind the door about what's happening policy-wise. Will this be an issue next fall? Maybe. But it is a vote that could put some Democrats in a tough position being fresh in the building.
There's support for policies that allow undocumented people to work here and live here if they don't have criminal records. I was looking for the Marquette poll that says that.
those, the way you ask those polling questions can really influence how that the numbers. I've seen all kinds of gaps or ranges of poll results when it comes to asking questions, depending how you ask it, right? And so there is, though, if you look at some polls, there is support to have deportations of people who aren't here legally. So again, depends how you ask it, but I'm not getting the impression from my conversations so far that there are many people who think that Trump and the administration targeting people who are accused of criminal crimes, who have a criminal history, that there's going to be a blowback for trying to target those folks and have them removed from the country. The question becomes, if you move to a true mass deportation system, like anybody here without documentation, and you start having massive roundups, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of people, then what happens? That's kind of like a ways away possibly, but we haven't quite got there yet to see how that might play out in the public eye.
I think what it was, I found it was in the Marquette poll. It was that 60% of registered voters oppose deporting immigrants in the U.S. illegally who have jobs and no criminal record.
Yeah. So again, if you ask that with the jobs, no criminal record, you'll get a different response than other ones. So it depends. Again, I think the bigger picture right now is the focus has been on those who have some kind of a criminal record or accused of something. If that's the focus, I don't get the impression in my conversations that people think that there'll be any real blowback for Donald Trump for having that kind of a target.
Well, and one of the things you mentioned or sort of alluded to is that Democratic Governor Tony Evers is almost certainly likely to veto any Republican immigration bill that's coming up, and whether this tees up immigration to be a big talking point in 2026 is what you were saying you're not sure of. But there's also more to this bill. Republicans want county sheriffs to hold people on ICE detainers, so people who are on immigration warrants that assert that someone's violated immigration law, not necessarily criminal law. They're not arrested on criminal law. Currently, Dane and Milwaukee County Sheriff's Departments don't do that and hold people on ICE detainers. What can you tell us about this? Do you know anything about that aspect?
Sure. And that's part of the reason why there's a provision in that bill now. There's a similar bill introduced last session. This one includes a penalty that you would lose 15% of your shared revenue, which is state aid, if you don't comply. One thing I'm watching with this entire thing is what's happening at the federal level. The Trump administration, I believe, filed a lawsuit late last week against Chicago and the state of Illinois over some of their policies in place, saying that they are basically an impediment to what's going on with cracking on and immigration. What happens there? That lawsuit could set the stage for how far-reaching the Trump administration can go with some stuff, go to the court, sign off on it. That could be really impact this whole debate going forward.
Well, thanks for the insights, JR, and thanks for joining me on Capitol Notes.
Anytime.
JR Ross is the editor of WisPolitics. He speaks with WUWM's Mayan Silver every other Monday for Capitol Notes. You can also find their conversations as a podcast. And just like Capitol Notes, Lake Effect is also a podcast. You can take it on the go with you or find it wherever you get your podcasts to listen on demand. Coming up later in the show, we'll explore Milwaukee Public Library's historic recipe collection, including an assortment of recipes from the 1960s.
So many with gelatin. I think that along with the mayo, it's kind of like, okay, what were we doing with gelatin at this time? Lots of meats in Jell-O and things like that. So blast from the past for sure.
But first, we'll look at the new book, Valiant Vel, all about the life of Milwaukee's own Vel Phillips. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Vel Phillips was a lot of historic firsts. She was the first Black person and the first woman to win an election for a statewide office in Wisconsin. She was the first woman and African American to serve on the Milwaukee Common Council. She was the first Black person and the first woman to serve as a jurist in Wisconsin, and the list goes on. But she was much more than her listed accomplishments could ever show. A new book for young readers called Valiant Vel explores the person behind the accomplishments, the experiences that shaped her, and what drove her fight for fair housing in Wisconsin. Author Jerrianne Hazlett joins me to talk about the book ahead of its launch party at Centennial Hall in the Milwaukee Public Library this Saturday. We're also joined by Michael Phillips, the son of Vel and Dale Phillips. This book is interesting because it doesn't merely list off Vel's accomplishments. It also really goes into the events that formed the adult she came to be. What were some of the formative events in her early life that really shaped the activist who she became?
She says herself, and I know this because thanks to Michael, I got to read a good deal of what she wrote. She had an unpublished, unfinished autobiography that was very insightful. And she states in the prologue to that, when she was in high school, she experienced the first really overt, unmistakable act of racial discrimination against her, and that really set her for her life to recognize it and what to do about it, and not to cave into it. And she was such a strong person. And as one of her acquaintances later in life said, she was so petite and dainty, polite, courteous. And he said she was an iron fist in a velvet glove. And I think that really describes her quite well.
One of the things that I know that formed her early sense of herself was an oratory contest that she engaged in back in, she was in high school. And that's one of the things that Jerrianne wrote about so well. Jerrianne, I just have to thank you for going ahead and authoring this piece. She was told by the teacher who was running this particular contest that there were four different speeches she could give. They had different categories, and none of those categories really fit for her. And even after she chose one, she was directed to the humorous category. And there's nothing, my mom didn't want it. She wasn't a comedian. She certainly wasn't a dancing doll, and it just wasn't right for her. So she wrote her own and then was barred from the competition. She went to a teacher that really liked her and explained, and this teacher then went to the principal. And there was a big kerfuffle about the whole thing. And anyway, my mom took her speech and with her proctor that didn't like her, and the teacher who did went to the principal, and the principal said, "Read it to me." And she read it, he liked it, and said, "Well, we'll allow her to give this speech outside of the categories that you've set for the rest of these students, and we'll see." It got around school, and there was this sort of a groundswell of support for her among the student body. But my aunt, who was her older sister, was trying to guide her away from that. My grandparents got involved. My grandmother kind of ran the show, and she said, if Vel can do this, we're going to support her. She gave her speech. The student body loved it to the point that they were stomping, apparently. She won the competition, and then she won the statewide, and then she won the national competition with that particular speech that she gave. So it was with that speech she went to Howard University. She won a scholarship, 4-year scholarship, to university of her choice.
It seems like in so many ways your mother's life was defined both by her accomplishments, but also the struggles caused by both her race and her gender. As she progressed through high school, college, and then later into her career, what were some of the obstacles that she had to overcome in order to get where she wanted to be and where she needed to be?
Oh, boy. Okay, well, she started in law school. My mother and father went to the University of Wisconsin Law School, and they were housed at a place nearby the residents simply said, we don't want any black people. And they're all students, right? We don't want any black people here. So they were forced to move out. This is 1940, just after the war. When they finally did graduate and they'd moved to Milwaukee, they opened the first African-American law office, part of the migration coming up from the South, the Southern diaspora of black folks north into the industrial areas. You know, Milwaukee was considered the hammer and anvil of the United States back then. It was a great place to work in a blue-collar way, and there was an expansion of black residents in the inner city such that it opened another aldermanic district, and my parents were like black lawyers, right? Young black lawyers. They were sort of at the heart of what we're going to do with this new aldermanic district. And there were people who were saying that my father should run. My father was like, yeah, I don't want to be a politician. It's not what I do. But Val, maybe you should run. And my mom, she liked the idea. So she did. She ran. One of the things my mother has said, and I'll never forget her saying it, is it was tougher for her to be a woman in politics than it was to be black. And so they hid the fact that she was a woman. They didn't have her picture on any of her campaign literature, and she changed her name legally to Vel from Velvalia. So she won. And there were plenty of people who were surprised that she was a black woman. But once she got in, she kind of had a Robert Kennedy kind of a moment. It's really what drove her candidacy. She went around and just saw the conditions that African-American people, black people, were living in at the time. People without heat, electricity, sometimes water, just squalor. And RFK, you know, 10 years later would go through that same sort of an idea. But she went through it in Milwaukee, and that drove her.
Fair housing is so much a part of this book. What was that fight like? Because it wasn't, you know, simply the marches that many of us might be familiar with. There was a lot that went into this overall fight.
Right. That was one thing, as Michael said. Belle had never seen that, even though she lived in the same city. She had never seen that, and she was appalled and said, this is not right. You know, we need to do something about it. And she even had personal experience herself, but she learned about people who tried to rent or buy a house in other areas, and they were denied. She began a campaign for open housing or fair housing in the city of Milwaukee. And the fair housing initiative that she was sponsoring, it took her a total of 6 years. She first introduced her ordinance in 1962. Took her a long time to research the laws, ordinances elsewhere, the federal government's position. So after several years of being an alderman, she introduced her ordinance. And, of course, it was voted down. It was 18-1. And she introduced it several times. So after that first introduction in 1962, she would bring it back, reintroduce it with some amendments, some change, some revision. And as I say, she did that for 5 years. She was not getting much traction outside, much public support outside of the council. It really was not getting public attention. And she got a call from a Catholic priest who asked to meet with her. And that really turned the tide. Father Garoppi is seen as the leader. He's the one who made the difference. He became the face of what really did catch public attention, and that was marching, protest marches. More and more people from other states would come and join the marches, and it got national attention. That really seemed to make the difference, and it was, that began in August of 1967, and a fair housing ordinance finally passed in April of 1968. So after six times, she did introduce it again, and that one didn't pass, but the council had changed somewhat, and there was a different, okay, this is giving the city of Milwaukee a really black eye, a really bad image to have all of these people out here marching and protesting, and all they want is to be able to live where they can afford to live in the city. So that was kind of the journey and the big turning point.
I got to say, another huge turning point were the assassinations of RFK and more significantly, Martin Luther King. And the Johnson administration, during sort of the final throes of it, decided that it would use its backdoor maneuvering to pass a federal fair housing law. And once a federal law passed, the Milwaukee Ordinance passed.
Yeah. Now, this is a book for young readers, although I'm sure adult readers can get quite a bit from it as well. And one of the things I find interesting about it is it really does speak to not just the accomplishment of Bell Phillips' life, but also her humanity, how she behaved inside of these situations, what they meant to her. Why was it important for you in writing this to really explore her humanity?
That's who she was, and I wanted to write a book about who she was. You can read newspaper clippings and learn all about what she did, but what drove her? And I think a lot of it was instilled by this matriarch, her mother. She had very strong principles. They were very strongly instilled principles, and that's what Vel lived by.
Now, as you think about Valiant Vel, this book, and, you know, the readers out there, what do you hope they take away from this?
I hope they will take away a knowledge of this astounding woman. And there are ways to be persistent. There's a way to sort of fight the system. And she showed a very effective way to fight the system. But it didn't happen overnight. It took years. And took a lot of support from areas that she had no idea were there to help her. You may feel beaten. You may feel no one cares. But look for doors to open. Look for doors that are already open. Don't say no. Be open to possibilities. And she never rested on her laurels either. She had an accomplishment, and she didn't sit back and say, well, done that, okay, time to take a nap. No.
Understand the times you live in and recognize the opportunities that present themselves for coupling with others of a like mind that you can work with and make change happen at the grassroots level. She was so much about that. I believe deeply that we can forestall some of the sort of the very worst of it by working together, getting together with people in the community that you meet. There are so many doors, there are so many windows, there are so many cracks available to reach and connect with folks. That's what we have to do.
Yeah. Well, Michael, Jerrianne, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having us.
What a great opportunity. I'm thrilled.
Jerrianne Haislett is the author of the new book for young readers, Valiant Vel, Vel Phillips and the Fight for Fairness and Equality. Michael Phillips is the son of Vel and Dale Phillips. There will be an event for the book launch this Saturday, February 15th, at Centennial Hall in the Milwaukee Public Library at 1 o'clock. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll share some historic recipes from the Public Library's collection in about 15 minutes. But first, we'll visit the historic Mitchell Street Library to explore the community kitchen housed in its makerspace. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The library is more than just books, and our series with the Milwaukee Public Library, Books and Beyond, showcases just that. We share resources, book recommendations, and some cool stuff you might not know about. Today, we're visiting the Cargill Community Kitchen in the makerspace of the Mitchell Street branch of the Milwaukee Public Library. It's run by Sherry Agee, who's been in the food service industry for over 20 years. To learn more about the kitchen and the programming offered for the community, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski met with Agee in the makerspace.
Before we get into the space we're in right now, I want to know where your passion for food and cooking comes from.
Primarily from my childhood, so stemming from my mother and my older sister preparing meals for the family growing up and just wanting to essentially be under their wing and learn how they were able to transform these ingredients to family meals that just became, you know, custom in our home. But that sparked my passion for creativity and then also wanting to serve. So that was, I would say, the birth of my culinary journey.
Well, and it's important to have family that are supportive and welcoming in the kitchen, right? It's easy to get overwhelmed and be like, kids out of the kitchen, you know? But how do you think that openness fostered that to begin with, and the importance of inviting people in to these spaces and also learning new skills?
It's the environment of a free space and where people feel safe to, one, be themselves and just have the courage to try new things, whether it's a new ingredient or learning about a new concept of food, a new technique on how to transform food. That environment is something that I felt at home, and I wanted to transcend that in the library space.
So before you came to the library, I'm curious about your own history in the culinary arts before you took the position of kitchen consultant here. So can you share some more of your food background that you made a career of?
Sure. So I started my culinary education at a junior college in Illinois in the food service management program, and then transferred to MATC's culinary arts program. And since then have been continuing my education with different certifications. SurfSafe is a food safety program that I have became certified in, but also am now in a position to teach as an instructor. So very excited about that, making individuals who also want to pursue a career in the food service industry to be better equipped. And then just a whole plethora of experience from mom-and-pop restaurants, the health industry, hospitals, assisted living centers, the travel sector. I worked at General Mitchell with one of the top food service providers, and then my own catering business.
Yeah, certainly a wealth of experience. And you joined MPL in the spring of 2022, and a major part of your initial work was rebuilding the library's culinary program after the pandemic, right? Which was a huge shift and challenge for many of us and all the jobs we do. So what were some of the main challenges or action items that stand out to you looking back at your first period of time starting here?
I would say just opening the door of people getting to know who I was. I was new to patrons, and the previous consultants, they already had established that culture with them and relationship with them. So me coming on board, just establishing the rapport with patrons, and then again, the environment that I wanted to create in our makerspace to just foster that sense of community and rebuilding what was lost or certainly diminished during the pandemic. It's just really just restructuring that and making people feel welcome and safe and being able to just reconnect.
Yeah, that's so important. You mentioned the makerspace, which is where we're sitting in right now at the Cargill Kitchen. Can you share more about the background of this kitchen and what it's named after?
So the Cargill Community Kitchen is made possible by the Cargill Company. So they had partnered with Milwaukee Public Library by way of creating this magnificent space to provide food programming. We are the one and only branch in the library, Milwaukee Public Library network, to offer food programming on this level because it is a full-scale community kitchen. The output of what has been created through different avenues of weekly series of food programmings and what we call special events, like our community meals, all are made possible by way of the community kitchen.
So you mentioned community meals. You also have programs such as Snack Hack, and I know the options of what you want to cook and prepare for the community are probably endless. So what are some of your guiding principles that help you shape your programming for the community here?
I do want to explore food options that, from my experience, most people may not have tried, because this might be the first experience for them right here at the library. So some common items I will add in the mix in terms of the menu that is supporting the Snack Hack curriculum, but I do want to continue adding those new experiences as well. So different ingredients that might be oddball to most of the patrons, I definitely want to expose them to learning that new piece that they can take home as a addition to their culinary awareness.
You mentioned an ingredient or a meal you might introduce may be someone's first exposure to that. Mm-hmm. So what are, say, some recipes, for example, that you help to share with people to kind of give them that introductory lesson, but also the recipe that's not too complicated, that it scares them away or intimidates them from a kitchen experience?
One that was most recently used in our World Cuisine section in our Snack Hack series was Caribbean themed. So we had traveled to Jamaica, and one of the ingredients called for a jerk seasoning, which a lot of the patrons were familiar with the commercially made blends, not really realizing that they can make this at home. And being able to learn how ingredients come together to get the results that you want in learning how to transform food was definitely an eye-opener for a lot of patrons.
There's the whole excitement and tool of being resourceful in the kitchen, whether it's making your own spice blends or knowing what to do with an ingredient and the versatility of it. So what is some of the feedback or takeaways you hear from attendees, and what kind of range of people do you see in your classes?
The feedback from the attendees have always been positive and a strong sense of gratefulness. A lot of patients will say, oh, I didn't know. I mean, even just as simple as the proper way of cooking rice. When I explained, you know, the general ratio of water to rice and the cooking technique to get the texture for that grain of rice, something that will seem, you know, that's like culinary 101 for me, but something very basic. I don't want to overlook that and not teach that to the attendees who may not know. And they're struggling in the kitchen. They're trying to figure out, well, why isn't this coming out right? Why is my rice mushy? And being able to walk through that when I do the cooking demonstrations are probably the biggest feedback from attendees. The age range is pretty vast. There are toddlers, so early elementary age in the Snack Hack Kids Kitchen program, all the way up to senior citizens that attend the Snack Hack 2.0, or I'll say my seasoned attendees
yes.
That attend Snack Hack 2.0, which is the adult program. Both are centered on food and nutrition, but the age groups are split to better suit the learning level.
So no matter the meal that you're preparing and helping to walk through with people, what are the main takeaways you hope your attendees take away from your time with them in the kitchen?
Be open to learning and to not be afraid in the kitchen. That it's okay to make mistakes. I literally explained that a lot of recipes were mistakes. That's how they came to be, because it was a arbitrary use of ingredients or a cooking technique, and then bam, it turned into this great recipe, and then it became documented and then duplicated, and now we have this kind of standardized recipe for something that originated as a mistake. So just being open to trying new foods or learning a new way to prepare a dish, and just not being afraid of your own creativity. You're not limited with food. There's so many possibilities, and even that is kind of is an understatement.
And I feel like that's one main intimidation roadblock for people, because they think cooking and baking is strict and you have to follow a recipe. And while for baking especially, like, yes, some components are important in order for it to turn out well, but you can put your own spin on it. And like, if you like certain flavors, you can add more of this and subtract some of that. And I think reminding people to be creative and embrace mistakes can help break down those initial barriers of intimidation that a lot of people face.
Exactly. I actually, in almost every session, I always explain that recipes are a guideline. With baking, yes, it is more of a science because too much baking powder in a recipe could completely destroy it. But with recipes where you have that flexibility, I always explain it to make it to your palate. So certain recipes that might have a heat element. I recently made a chili casserole from our historic recipe file, and it called for cinnamon, which was unique. That was actually the first chili recipe of all the chilies I've made. That was the first recipe that called for cinnamon. I was like, that's a unique ingredient. But I wanted to try it only because I was unfamiliar with it. And once that chili was cooked and I presented it, I did not have enough to serve everyone, including seconds. So they were open to trying something new. None of the attendees had heard of cinnamon in a chili recipe, just like myself. So we were learning together, which is also just a great element in food programming as well when we are on this journey together.
So we are in February, and of course the Milwaukee Public Library System has a month-long Black History Month celebration, and a community meal as a part of your programming here is part of that. So can you share any details of this upcoming program that you have?
Yes, so on Saturday, February 22nd, from 12 o'clock to 2 o'clock, we have our first community meal of the year right here at Mitchell Street Library. The focus is the author that we wanted to highlight. So the name of the community meal is We Eat to Remember, which is the title of our author's book with poet Fabu. So Dr. Fabu Phyllis Carter is a renowned poet who is going to grace us with her presence and learn a little bit more about her. And she's actually will do a reading from her book, which will also be available at the end of our community meal for a signing opportunity and to meet her in the flesh, which I think is awesome. And then the meal that I will prepare from our community kitchen.
I love the creativity of that and also bringing poetry and cooking together. Mm-hmm. And I imagine it's a fun change of pace for you too. So what are some of your favorite parts of this job and some of the new challenges you get to meet with each meal?
It is the creativity, first and foremost, and then just the broader platform versus the weekly series. The community meal attendance is significantly larger. The average count is 65 versus about 18 to 20 for the weekly programs. And then the community meals are themed. So I love the opportunity to pick a specific concept, or if it's a seasonal focus, I get to, I don't want to say play around with it, but I get to have the broader platform to reach more people. And they are attending in big numbers. So we are doing a great, or meeting a great need, because they're returning and they're coming back and they're sharing their experiences. And this is an opportunity that they probably wouldn't expect at the library because it is non-traditional, but the community meals are my way of being able to break the mold and to show the evolution of libraries.
Well, Sherry, I want to thank you so much for welcoming me into your space today and for sharing more.
Thank you very much. Hope to see you soon.
Sherry AG is the Cargill Community Kitchen Consultant at the Milwaukee Public Library Mitchell Street branch. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. The next community meal called We Eat to Remember will be held on February 22nd in honor of Black History Month. It'll feature poet Dr. Fabu Phillips Carter. You can find more information at wuwm.com. Whether you're cooking at the Cargill Community Kitchen or looking to prepare something at home, you may need to follow a recipe. Today, it's easy to quickly look up any kind of recipe online. But before the internet, people frequently called Milwaukee Public Library's Ready Reference to get help finding recipes. Librarians clipped recipes from the Milwaukee Journal over the course of 20 years. Today, it's a digitized collection called the Historic Recipe File, a searchable database that holds over 5,400 recipes. So if you're interested in recreating State Fair cream puffs at home, or you want to make cabbage crust spinach pie, the recipe file is a great place to look. Library Services Manager Christina Gomez joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share more.
So what is the Historic Recipe File, and how was this compiled?
Yeah, so the Historic Recipe File is actually a collection of hundreds of recipes that were clipped between 1960 and 1980 by librarians at Milwaukee Public Library, and they clipped these recipes directly from the Milwaukee Journal and the Milwaukee Sentinel. We would get lots of calls here at the library, people asking for these recipes, you know, before the internet. So we decided to collect all of these so that we could share with people via phone.
As you mentioned, it's one of the things we take for granted on the internet is instant, you know, access, and you can look up information, recipes. But thinking about a librarian double checking a newspaper clipping for someone is really endearing to me, like at the ready reference desk, ready to answer recipe questions.
Yeah. And they were super popular. You know, we've always had cookbooks, but folks were really into the recipes that were published in our daily papers here in Milwaukee. And a lot of them actually were recipes from local restaurants, things that had relevance to our region. Actually, one of my favorites is there was a recipe for the State Fair cream puffs. So that was a really popular one as well, if you wanted to try and make your own if you couldn't get to the State Fair. So
as you mentioned, the collection of these recipes offers a glimpse into the foods that were popular in Milwaukee decades ago. What stands out to you about the variety of recipes? I know there's thousands, right? I assume most have mayo in them, but some are pretty standard. But yeah, what does it kind of tell about what people were looking forward to in the papers?
Yeah, well, like you mentioned, thousands, right? So we have actually over 5,000 recipes in the collection. What stands out to me is the wide range of international options. I think that surprised me a bit, to be honest. We, of course, have recipes from, you know, German foods, Polish foods, but also West African. I saw a recipe for fufu in there, a ton from Eastern Europe, as well as Latin America. So that's always really fun to browse through. So many with gelatin. I think that along with the mayo, it's kind of like, okay, what were we doing with gelatin at this time? Lots of meats in Jello and things like that. So blast from the past for sure. And yeah, another that stood out to me is the wide range of vegetarian options. That was a bit surprising. I don't necessarily think of that when I think of those decades when I was looking through. Actually, my niece is vegetarian, so I was kind of looking through it, and what kind of stood out to me, there was one for dandelion omelet. And I was like, okay, that would be interesting. If you're into foraging and you grab some dandelions, that could be a fun recipe to explore.
And I also really like that some of the recipes were featured from restaurants that are no longer here, because I think food memory is such a big component of who we are and the cultures we grow up in.
Yeah, it's a part of our history, right? Like our shared history of our city. So I think in that way, it's also a really great glimpse into Milwaukee, like what our community members back then were eating when they went out and what they enjoyed to make at home.
Now, you mentioned a couple recipes. Have you tried making any of them? Do others stand out because they're simply ones you would never try because of the ingredients?
Yeah, there was one with some interesting kind of like game meats, which I'm not super into, like rabbit and other things like that. But I have made one. I actually made albóndigas, which are just Spanish meatballs. And it was delicious. It was very simple to make. I cut back on the lard a bit because that's also an ingredient that appears in lots of these recipes. But it was really good. It was easy to make, easy to find. So I appreciated that.
Yeah. You mentioned over 5,000 recipes. Yes. Is this collection continuing to grow?
It's not. So the librarian stopped clipping the recipes from the paper probably about in the 80s. So right now, you know, that size is what it is. But luckily, it's all digitized. So anyone can access it online, and you can search by either like a regional cuisine. So if you wanted to, you know, kind of look up what Polish recipes we have, you could find it that way. You could also just search by ingredient. So if you have certain ingredients in your pantry and you want to figure out how to make it, you could also search the collection that way.
And I like the scan digitization of these recipes because it is, in a way, like looking at an old recipe card, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So you can see actually the handwriting of the librarians at the time. Sometimes they wrote little notes right on the recipes themselves. So that's very cool to look at.
I love it. Well, definitely a lot to explore here, and I might try my hand at one of these recipes. So, Christina,
thank you
so much for sharing more about the historic recipe file.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Christina Gomez is the Library Services Manager at Milwaukee Public Library. She joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about the historic recipe collection. At WUWM.com, you can find a link to the recipe collection and explore our past Books and Beyond conversations. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look at Milwaukee Film's Black History Month programming. Plus, we'll hear from a UW professor who collaborated with Bad Bunny on his latest album. Thank you so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.